Hi, welcome to the Boston Book Festival, the best panel, I think. Welcome. I'm Robin Young from WBER and NPR here and now, and we love books, and you do too. So thanks for coming out to support this particular panel, which is, how many have read one of the books? How many have read two? How many have read three? Okay. Those of you heading for three, you are in luck. They are just terrific reads. Let's first make a couple of announcements here. There will be book sales afterwards. Last year, everybody stormed the stage. This year, we're going to ask you to please go to the back of the room where the book sales are going to be. And you know the drill. You'll get a book, and you'll get it signed back there. Also, there's a survey. There are survey forms, and we'd really appreciate feedback. You can either do the survey form or do it online. It helps the Boston Book Festival grow every year, but also you have a chance to win an iPad MIDI if you take part in the survey, so please do that. So let us welcome our panelists. I'm going to start with Lauren Oliver's Rooms. Lauren is the fabulously successful young adult author, but in Rooms, this is a very adult book, ghosts trapped in a house, forced into a deliciously gossipy Greek chorus for the family that comes to empty that house after their estranged patriarch dies in it. The house and its history haunts the family, but as NPR said in a review, the stories of the women in her characters haunt us, the readers, as we will hear. William Giraldi, his last book was Busy Monsters. This one is Hold the Dark. It follows a nature writer, also haunted by his past, into a secluded village in the Alaskan tundra. A mother has asked him to come to find the wolf that she says has taken her child, and we and the wolf tracker are plunged into a story of nature gone awry, as the New York Times said. Trackers and predators, man, women, wolf. And I have to say, it's been a long time since I've been so compelled and propelled by words to look at something I really don't want to see. So that is William Giraldi's Hold the Dark. Ben Mezrich, we know him, of course, for his past books that have become movies. Seven Wonders is the new one, and it's the events that propel us in this book. As the back jacket says, a fast-paced, globe-trotting thrill ridden with historic secrets, conspiracies, wonders old and new. That sounds like a movie pitch, and it kind of was. He takes us from the Colosseum to Machu Picchu to Rio's Christ figure. Our protagonist climbs his face. He's kind of like a Harrison Ford for the MIT set. And we understand that it began with a producer suggesting the idea to you. So we want to hear more about all these books, but please welcome our authors. Ben, start with you. You've had both Bringing Down the House, became 21, Bringing Down the House, the story of the betting ring out of, the gambling ring out of MIT, Accidental Billionaires became The Social Network. And we understand you called one of your former producers who worked with you right. And said, I'm kind of looking for an idea.
Yeah, so Brett Ratner, can you hear me? I don't know.
It's weird for
us. Brett Ratner, the director who just had the movie Hercules and he did the Rush Hour movies, he was a producer on the movie 21 about the MIT kids. He was a producer for about a day, but we got to know each other. And over the years, every time I'm in between books, I always make calls to certain people looking for the next story. And usually I call Brett, and he tells me some terrifying story that's going to get me killed. Like there's these gun runners in Miami or these like drug dealers and so, and I never really want to do his stories. And this time I was on the phone with him, and he said, you know, I got an idea, but it's a thriller. It's like a Da Vinci Code, Indiana Jones. We want to kind of do a new take on Indiana Jones. And so it wasn't nonfiction, but... I started meeting with him, and I wrote a 20-page or 30-page book proposal about the seven wonders of the world. The idea was if we could link the seven wonders of the world somehow, we could create a big kind of globe-trotting movie experience. So I wrote this pitch, and then we sold it as a trilogy of films to 20th Century Fox, and then I sold it as a book. So it kind of started as a movie this time, which is an interesting process because as you're writing it, you kind of are... looking in that direction more, although I've always kind of looked in that direction anyways, but it worked out, and so the book is called Seven Wonders. Yeah.
Well, but this might make some hackles rise in literary circles. Dennis Lehane did the same thing
recently.
Dennis,
and you know what? I'm used to making the hackles rise. I know there's a lot of critics who have issues with the way I write nonfiction anyways, because I write thrillers that happen to be true, turning Mark Zuckerberg into a character who's having sex in the basement of a dorm room wasn't necessarily every critic's dream, but it kind of worked out. So I don't really have a problem with that, but I do understand. I always think cinematically. I write cinematically. Every time I've sat down to write a book, from my very first book, I've thought of it as a movie.
You say you don't mind if hackles rise. There are some demonstrated hackles right on this panel. William Giraldi, I want to go over to you, who had a famous dust-up in the literary world. You have to Google it. It had to do with a review that you wrote about somebody else's book, No Need to Go Deeper, except to say, words and writing and ideas coming, the literary aspect as opposed to the cinematic aspect of writing is very important to you.
Yes, indeed it is. I believe that language is the test. It's the test for any book. Language that is vibrant, that has verve, language that has the ability to reach into both redemption and damnation, which is where I believe all literature takes place, on that plane between the damned and the redeemed.
Can I steer you towards the book? Because there's a lot of damned, not a lot of the redeemed. I mean, here's the New York Times, a book, this is again, Hold the Dark. I started this book at 9:00 at night and I finished at 2:00 in the morning. I mean, it is just propulsive. But the New York Times says, a book all but bereft of levity, spectacularly violent, intimately written. Where did you go to find these characters, these people that I think the Times also said are better left alone, such dark secrets, such cold hearts?
Yeah. Well, the story is set in a remote village on the Alaskan tundra, and what happens is that some children go missing, and one of the mothers who's lost a child calls in this naturalist, a nature writer, and a wolf expert to investigate what possibly could have happened to her son and to the others. And of course, once he gets there to this remote village on the lip of the tundra, he finds a darkness that goes much deeper and is much more perverse than wolves. I begin a story not with a story, and in fact not even with characters, but I begin with language. And the language of this book was what spoke to me first. I'd been hearing this voice that sounded part lyrical, part searching, and all of a sudden, I realized after several months of hearing this voice that it was the voice of this character, and so that's what I begin with.
But when you talk about words, it's not just cold; it's what?
It's not just
cold on the tundra. It's what? I'm asking you to pull from memory, which is not fair, but you know some of the ways you use words.
Right. Well, I'll tell you. I was asked about this recently, how I imbued the Alaskan tundra with its own personality. And I wasn't quite aware of doing that, but after someone pointed that out to me, I realized that it was important to make inanimate objects, in this case, the wilderness, and a very malevolent wilderness at that, take on human characteristics that used to be known as the pathetic fallacy. But I think there's something that was absolutely integral to this story, that this remote place that most Americans don't know anything about. In fact, I didn't know much about it either before I began. But it's as far as you can go in America, and it's a moonscape. It's absolutely alien terror, T-E-R-R-A, but also T-E-R-R-O-R, I assure you. And so, you know, I think that the ice and the snow and the knolls and the crags, this they began to have human personality to me.
Right.
And so I think that's where some of the language came from.
Well, I just opened to one page. The dead had been frozen, stuck to the ground by their blood and entrails. They had to be scraped off the earth with shovels or pried with pickaxes. In another, a father and son are talking about wolves. His father had told him the wolves can hear one another across 3 miles. They can hear each other howl, the boy asked. No, his father said, they can hear each other breathe. That is Hold the Dark, William Giraldi. I want to get back to both of these books, but Lauren, you had to figure out, and I've loved your young adult books. We've spoken before about those. And as I was reading, I was thinking, wow, you had to spend time trying to figure out how ghosts are. I mean, when a door opens and a breeze comes through, they get all scattered. You know, where did you come to this wanting to trap ghosts in a house?
Well, to some extent, I was curious. I grew up in a very old house, and to some extent, rooms, which it came from my desire to render literal the idea of, well, I mean, on a basic level, the idea of if these walls could talk, what you say about, you know, houses having borne witness to the events of a lifetime. When I was little, I used to really wonder about the people who must have lived in the rooms before me and the people who would come after me without having any sense of the fact that I had been there alive and you know, experiencing all these joys and heartbreaks. And I used to wonder whether there was some way in which we left almost a residue, you know, on the things we handle, on the places that we have been and grown and loved. You know, I mean, one of the great human capacities is obviously the capacity to, and in fact, maybe the impetus to render objects symbolic, which is why, you know, we use relics in church and religious ceremonies. It's why when somebody breaks a china dish that your grandmother gave you, even if it's worthless, you might sit there bawling. So I really wanted to tell a story about our relationships to objects, how we express ourselves through them, and they kind of become a part of us. And so with the ghosts, what was really fun is that I wanted the house to actually have its own almost corporeality, kind of like I was thinking about how in phantom leg syndrome, when people lose limbs, they often report sensation, that they can feel sensation, including sometimes infuriatingly itches in these limbs that are no longer there. So I thought, well, I kind of took that idea and it was very fun to play with it. Like, if you lost your whole body, would we still be able to kind of mentally map out onto this space a sense of our own, you know, of a body the way that we know it and understand it?
Buddhists believe that, you know, when you have a chair for a long time, you are infused in that chair. But I don't want to give anything away, but these starts with two female ghosts. You know, they're stuck with each other. Yeah. And at first it's very funny. There's kind of this, what would it be like if you were stuck with somebody you didn't really like just because you ended up having to be ghosts in the same place?
Right.
But it becomes, I was surprised at how, I shed some tears at the end of this book. And what it becomes is more of a look at women. And women and how they feel about themselves. I just, there's one line from Alice, one of the ghosts that comes along the course. I know what I looked like, a devoted wife, then a cautious widow, a dry, dusty, throwaway woman like many others, a woman made to fade and dry out and die shaking in her hollow skin. She was a ghost before she was a ghost.
Well, I mean, it's a lot about, actually not deliberately in some ways, but, you know, it was actually really belatedly that I realized there are almost no men in the book. And the ones that do are usually kind of problematic, but don't know where that came from. You know, I think actually, I mean, it's a lot about the the women in this are all failing in some ways in their roles that traditionally define womanhood. They are not successful.
Even after death.
Yeah.
Even after their
they're
death.
Not successful mothers. They are not successful wives.
They're not successful ghosts.
No, they're not successful in anything, basically. It's a lot of unsuccessful people. Actually, I was just saying before to William, before the panel started, that the funny thing about this book is that afterwards people have, you know, either criticize me or often just been very bewildered about why, you know, the characters in this book are so unsympathetic, which is strange because I don't think they're unsympathetic at all. I mean, they're deeply, deeply flawed. And I mean, to some extent, obviously, it's incredibly boring to write about people who are not dysfunctional in some way. But I just think it's ironic that I had no idea I was writing about unsympathetic people. I was like, wait, but these are all like everybody I know. I guess I need new friends.
Well, I want to ask you all about, there's sort of a haunting scariness to this this particular panel. And I guess, you know, do your characters haunt you? And Ben, actually, more to the point with you, do your older characters haunt you?
Zuckerberg?
Yeah.
Haunts me.
No, I mean, well, you know, here you are. You've got this swashbuckling anthropologist.
Right.
But he's also breaking all the rules. I'm reading a great book, Lives in Ruins. It's a nonfiction about anthropologists. It's fantastic. But they would be very upset with your anthropologist taking a little specimen here and there
right.
off, you know,
he's
these
kind of an
place.
Anthropologist grave robber in a sense.
Well, he breaks the rules like right. all your characters do,
they
real
do,
and
yeah.
fiction.
Well, I'm fascinated by people who break the rules, people who live in that gray area between right and wrong, whether it's strapping $250,000 to your body and going to Vegas or, you know, creating a social network because you want to get laid or whatever it is you're doing because you're not in that straight and narrow and you're trying to change the rules. And so in Seven Wonders, it's an anthropologist who's looking for these clues to link the Seven Wonders, but and I modeled it somewhat on a real anthropologist, but I took it that next step. So it really is kind of the Harrison Ford type character where
if it were an anthropologist being chased by modern day Amazons.
Right, and there are modern day Amazons in it. It's a yeah. kind of a lot of things going on. But I mean, I wouldn't say I'm haunted. I'm actually a very not dark person. I'm a very light person. is that the right word? So I'm not haunted by anything really, but I do sort of carry with me all the stuff I learned in the journeys through each and every book. I've done, this is my 15th book, I guess, and I go inside some pretty crazy worlds. I was hanging out with a fugitive in Antigua for the last book who's literally stuck on the island of Antigua because of a poker site he had built, and he's worth $50 million, but it only lives in a little house and he can't leave. And so there is kind of this darkness to that. But then I try and take it into a light place because he's got a Ferrari and he's got... So, so I look at the bright side of the haunting, I guess is the way to put it.
But, William, I can't imagine that you don't... didn't for a long... Well, do you tell me, did you dream this for a long time? I did, as a reader.
Well, you're so sweet.
But no.
Well, hey, I'm Catholic. I was raised in darkness. And, you know, one of the things I think Hold the Dark is about is the enigma of evil, and as that is manifest in nature. And lately I've been written about as a Catholic novelist, and uncomfortable for
someone. Yeah, what does it mean? What does that mean?
What does Catholic mean? You're flesh obsessed. You're blood obsessed. You love pageantry. You love drama. You love ritual, and you have a Christ haunted personality, as as was said of the great Flannery O'Connor, Christ haunted. This was a shock to me to be reading about myself in these Catholic terms because I left the Catholic Church many years ago. But what I've discovered is that one doesn't really leave the Catholic Church. It stays with you always. That perspective, that conception of mythos and of drama, and as I say, pageantry, it's always with one, I think. That's how powerful, I think, Catholicism in particular is. They get you with the drama. They get you with the darkness. I can remember being at Mass when I was a child, and the crucifix at the fore of the church wasn't just Christ hanging there looking divine and beautiful. I mean, he was bruised and battered and bloody, and this was the point, right? This was the point. And so... Yes, I dream these things quite often. I have Catholicism to thank. I think.
Okay. Well, Lauren, I know it started me thinking about, again, we're sort of staying with the religious theme. How appropriate! But wow, if there really is a purgatory, and that's the purgatory, that's tough to be stuck in this house having to watch these parade of other people come through and you can't do anything, you can't get out.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's also a larger, perhaps bleaker commentary on the fact that purgatory, I mean, there's kind of the living purgatory that we all have is that you have to kind of live with yourself and with the choices you've made and, you know, and with your errors. I mean, I think probably, you know, and this might relate to, again, my sense of my characters is not unsympathetic, but I was not raised religiously. My father studies, my father is a very celebrated scholar, nonfiction scholar of serial killers and psychopathic sex murderers. So when I was 8, my favorite party trick was to act out for guests the strangulation and murder and dismemberment of Grace Budd, pretending to be Grace Budd. And that was what I did for my parents' friends. So I once told my therapist that, and he was like, we're going to need some more sessions. And but from the start, I had a sense of what, like, the expanse of human capacities. And my parents are also both professors of literature and would also sit down at the table and read Emily Dickinson poems, and we would talk about them. And they, you know, they really celebrated the beauty of I mean, they're very, very serious about art and intellectualism and all of the passions that it can bring. So I had this huge, tremendous range and sense of what people can do, and also then the small ways, obviously most of us are not serial killers, thankfully, but the small ways in which people can be truly kind of cruel and, you know, do terrible, terrible things under the right set of circumstances. So I'm really interested in that. I'm really interested, you said it you know, between the damned and the redeemed, and I always talk about it as this liminal space where you know, distinctions kind of, and same thing with what you were saying, but where distinctions start to erode, and there's just this, there's something else to explore there. So.
Well, so interesting you say that, unlike William, some of this, if I'm hearing you correctly, some of this didn't come from an infused religion. I don't want to give anything away because both these books, you know, well, all three, although more in a cinematic way, but they have endings we don't want to give away. But how does put this? The reason some ghosts are trapped and some ghosts aren't have to do with things that some people would consider sins.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, again, I think my sister and I weren't raised with any particular morality or moral conception. I mean, my father's Jewish, my mom's Catholic, but they're both atheists. My sister is a professor of philosophy, but she's also recently become, she recently got baptized about 2 months ago. I'm a heathen. I shouldn't say that in a church. But maybe if I call it a heathen, it will be okay. Yeah, exactly. But I wanted to say about the haunting, you know, and I would be curious about whether this is true because I know how much language is important to you. But, you know, I'm not haunted. It's not, I mean, I am. You think about your characters and you fixate on them. But I'm more haunted with the tremendous effort of transposing onto the page in language the kind of sensibility and feelings. Like, it's the sentences that haunt me, how to get them out.
It's writing.
Yeah. It's writing that haunts me. Writing haunts me.
I mean, that, you know, makes me want to throw up sometimes. And I, you know, just trying to get it the right way.
Absolutely.
Lawrence, I think absolutely right about that. The sentences are the key. And I said earlier that it's the test. It's the only test for literature. Are these sentences vibrant, or are they infused with cliche, with platitude, or is it the easily available verb? Is it the obvious noun? Is it full of indolent adjectives? This is how one can tell. I get attacked quite a bit for saying that you can prove how one book is better than another, and you can prove it with the sentences. And that sounds not so cozy to a lot of people, I think. There's a kind of egalitarian feeling among writers, I believe, where everyone is doing his best. Some of that best isn't quite good enough, I think. And so I agree with Lauren. Language has to be the test.
Google. I can't wait till you review one of my books.
Well, I would try to steer clear. Google William Giraldi scathing review. That's all we're going to say. But Ben, you are in a different direction. I mean, you've got the movie, and you're already working on another book, I understand, that's a movie concept.
I think I have 6 movies in pre-development right now, and I just sold a television show based on one of my other books yesterday and took the red eye back, so if I look weird, that's why. I've always looked to Hollywood, and while I write, I think there's a real synergy going on, especially the way the book business is going. You have to marry the two now if you want to look forward in your career in a lot
Dennis
of ways.
Well, Dennis Lehane says there's no, you know, there is art in television.
Course. I mean, listen, TV is where a lot of the great art is going on right now. If you look at what's going on in cable, it's amazing, you know, from the Breaking Bads all the way to the Sons of Anarchy. And there's a million shows now where writer is king, and that's happening a lot. Hollywood is now moving towards these big spectacle movies, which is a little bit less of the art, I guess. But, yeah, I mean, I think there's not that big division anymore. I mean, this is where I probably would differ with you in a lot of it, in that, you know, you can find art in a lot of different places if you look for it.
But I think you'd say that the art would be in the well-constructed sentence.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, you can tell a good movie from a bad movie in a similar way in that, you know, it works or it doesn't work. But, yeah, I'm definitely working a lot in that direction, although the book is the thing I love, and I write the book, and then see it turn into something is kind of the experience I'm looking for.
So I know I read about one about Russian
Yeah, this
oligarchs.
Is kind of a book that I'm really reluctant to. I was reluctant to write it. I'm reluctant that it's coming out and reluctant to talk about it all. This is basically a very big book that is coming out early spring that I really didn't want to write. And I basically, it started with Brett Ratner again, as these things often do, and he said, you got to come to London. And I was like, why? And he said, you got to meet somebody. So I flew to London, and I met somebody very frightening.
I was going to say, is that person dead now?
No. But it, probably 80% of the people in the book are. And it's a story of Russian oligarchs. The first time people are talking and telling the whole story of where Putin came from, of how all this incredible amount of wealth happened and how they all ended up either dead or in London. And I'm not really that kind of writer. And I spent a lot of time going back and forth from London almost on a weekly basis meeting with these people. And I kept saying, no, 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 I'm never going to write this book. No, no, no. And now the book is done.
Nice to know you.
Right. But it's going to be a very big movie, and it's a different sort of it's you'll see.
Strikes me there's a story there about a writer who really didn't want to do that.
We have one meeting. We have one meeting, and Brett Ratner turns to one of these guys and goes, "We're not going to get killed for this, are we?" And the guy goes, "You watch too many movies." And then Brett's like, "Well, what if we say something wrong?" And he says, "Don't say something wrong." Like, oh, man. I mean,
on a super serious note, the journalist was poisoned in London for getting too close to the story of what's going on there. So, but, William, what about you? I mean,
I feel fine, though. I'm fine right now. I'm fine.
He was poisoned. Right. After this, you know, really immersing, I can't say enough about the muscle of it.
You should be my agent, I think. You are so sweet to me.
I have been tweeting about this panel all week. I feel I'm the luckiest person because of the authors that I'm with. But do you have to shake it off for a while, or what do you do next, or have you already done it?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I sympathize with Ben when he says that I know that feeling of not wanting to write a book. I didn't want to write Hold the Dark, really. I had a contract to do it, and I needed to do it. And I didn't want to go to that, to the shadow place in this book. And it required a kind of intensity that I hadn't ever experienced before. And the book is really short. It's only 200 pages, but it took me 3 years to write. And how did that happen? There were some days when I would sit all day long and have maybe 2 sentences all day. I come out with two sentences. And I made myself a little bit mad, I think, trying to get it exactly right. Every word, every comma. And it was maddening, and I didn't want to do it because it was hard, and I'm a fundamentally lazy guy. I don't even want to talk about work, never mind do it. And writing is, there's a lot of romanticism around the writing and the writer. And I think that's completely erroneous. It's a miserable life. If it's done with the kind of intensity and the pitch, the pitch of language that I believe it needs to be done at, it's very hard. And it's really difficult when you're so lazy. And I've got two little kids, and we live in a really small place in Cambridge, and they're always, I'd much rather play with my boys than write, and so they were constantly distracting me, but I was gladly distracted, to get away from the cauldron of darkness in this book, and that kind of repelling down deep inside yourself to give birth to this thing, and you never really sure where it's going. I think you have the vaguest idea of where you might end up, but it's changing almost every day. It sort of takes on a breath and a pitch and a torsion of its own, and you almost feel like you're being used by whatever force is telling this story. I know that sounds ghoulish, but there is the very hard part of getting the sentences right, too, which was so onerous. And so I don't really want to write another book. I would love to find something else I could do.
Well, you teach literature at BU.
I do. I teach at BU, but...
Which means you still need something else to do.
Yeah. I see these farmers, and I think, oh, that looks nice, They're outside, it's fresh air, they exercise. I mean, I say, oh, I'd love that. Or you know what looks really great? A UPS driver. Well, the uniforms are great, but also, all day by yourself, you just carry boxes in and out, you're in that truck, it looks beautiful. Whenever I'm sitting at my desk and I just cannot write a sentence, I look out at the UPS driver, and I think, oh, you want to switch places? But it's too late for me.
The UPS driver apparently is the new fantasy of women, the UPS driver.
I see that. I fantasize about them. I can see that.
What was the old fantasy?
I don't know. The mailman. I don't know. No, Lauren, I was so taken by these characters and also was thinking as I was reading, what's she going to do? Is she going to stay? This is an adult read. We are reminded that ghosts can see you. They can see you when you are having sex. Even when you're alone having sex, they can see you.
True.
And it suddenly makes you think in a whole different way, when you're kind of moving through your life. So it's not a young adult book. This was an adult book. Mm-hmm. Do you go back?
Yeah, I'm going to do both. I mean, I have different kind of interests. There are different things that you can explore. I write children's books as well, like for 8 to 12. So, chapter books. They're not like picture books. But I think that being able to do all three is my dream, ultimately. I'm kind of an omnivorous reader. I always have been. I read very widely. I read literary fiction. I read a ton of nonfiction. I'm like a total sucker for any locked door mystery that takes place that may or may not have been committed, like with an egg cozy and there's a butler involved. Like I love, love anything of that nature. I read a lot of philosophy. So I just read really widely. I read children's books as well. And I think I'm inspired by different things. So both. I mean, I have a new resolution to myself, which is to be a better writer. I even have Be a Better Writer on my computer, so I won't forget. And one of the things that's important for me next, so I have two books that I'm working on. One of them's adult and one of them's young adult. The adult one is going to require a lot of research, which is really different and new for me, so I anticipate it's going to take a really long time, so I'm not putting any time limit on when that will happen. But I kind of have this idea of returning to kind of become a student again, because I feel that in the past couple of years, I've gotten more and more entangled with not the writing, or not as much the writing, obviously, when I'm writing, but even when the books come out, then I worry so much about how they're going to do or what the reactions are. And it's not fun, and it's not related to writing. So I'm, in the next year, doing a lot of, I'm enrolling in a lot of classes and stuff. I mean, I loved being a graduate student in writing. It was a dream. And so that's what I'm going to be doing. Like, that's my next plan, is to also become, to kind of retrain myself and restore, I think, some of that. I mean, writing is very hard, but also there is some kind of, maybe not joy, but if it's what you do, you can't not do it. Right. It is a calling. I mean, I really do think that's true. Yeah. So,
well, whatever the three of you do next, I will be there. Thank you. What you do have in common, all of you, is that you've just vastly entertained us and engaged us. So Ben Mezrich, Lauren Oliver, William Giraldi, thank you so much. Yeah. Now, we want to have... We want to make sure we've had time for some questions, so there are some people wandering around with a microphone. Let's have them raise their hands, find them. We'll take a couple questions before the book signings. And while we wait for the first question, can I ask Ben's son to come up here? Did he make it?
I think he might have gone.
Or they might have left.
He went to a Halloween party.
Oh, it's the best Transformers costume.
He's got a Transformer costume.
Oh, well. Okay. So do we have questions? Just raise your hand up high, and we can't see because we have, up here we have one right here. And who has the microphone? Right here? Mm-hmm. And just state your name and...
Hi, I'm Elizabeth. Yeah. Lauren, welcome to adult fiction. I'm so excited. I cannot tell you how excited I am. But a question for all of you. We've heard about what haunts you. I'm curious what changes you. As you write a book and you leave it behind, how are you different from before you wrote to after you wrote?
Question to all three, so as briefly as you can. What's changed you, having written the book you just we've just talked about? Ben?
Oh, written Seven Wonders, what changed me? I don't think this book necessarily changed me dramatically. I hadn't written a big fictional thriller ever before, and I hadn't written fiction in 15 years. It was definitely a very different experience for me, although plenty of reviewers have said I've been writing fiction all along, so to be fair. But I do spend a lot of time researching. Researching is my favorite part of writing. I spend a good... more than half of the time going inside the story and seeing the world. So, you know, things like the Taj Mahal, things like Christ the Redeemer, I mean, these are immense works. And when you see them and then think about humanity, it certainly affects you. It's like, wow, we did this and we haven't destroyed it yet. That's pretty good. So that, I guess in a way, that's life-changing.
Yep. Lauren?
I think that, you know, for me, the books that I write, I don't know, this is a strange metaphor, but it's almost like, they're almost like little elbows and they push out and extend the boundaries, not just of what you can do, but really just what you want to do next. I think writing rooms reminded me of some of the things that I'm still not very good at in fiction, reminded me of all of the things that I really want to be better at. It kind of made fissures through which I can now see some platonic ideal on the other side that I would like to kind of reach for and I'm sure failed to grasp entirely, but you know, can kind of, it opens you in some ways.
Hmm. Well, you know what was compelling for me was, and I think this might apply to all three of us, this idea of, I had to get comfortable with this word genre, right? Because it's a bastardized word, right? When you say, oh, that's genre fiction, it usually means it's insubstantial, it's featherweight, it's not to be taken seriously. I wasn't even aware that I was doing that. I mean, I was shocked when my publisher came back and said, oh, we love this literary thriller. I said, a what? What is this? I mean, I thought I was writing this book about nature and damnation, and all of a sudden I had this literary thriller. So I had to get comfortable with that. And I think when the reason this word genre, or this the whole category, whether it's romance or horror or
all of these vampire stories or what have you. I think it has such a terrible reputation because it's mostly so terribly written. And it's important to know that it really didn't begin that way. When you look at Jules Verne or Edgar Allan Poe or Conan Doyle or Lovecraft, I mean, these were master stylists and beautiful makers of sentences. And so for me, I had to get used to living in that space, someone who grew up with a conception of literature as Henry James, that kind of rolling interiority of Henry James, which, let's be honest, can be very dull, very dull indeed. And so this wedding, this alloy of the interior and the exterior, which in this case turned out to be this chase story with wolves and a psychopath. And also, what was important is the fiction that I think we're inundated with, the literary fiction that we're inundated with in our culture right now, is this sort of Carverian domestic drama. You know, the marriage is shot, the rent is due, grandma's sick, and it just seems to me to be just another played out simulacrum of reality, right, in which verisimilitude is confused for imagination. And I think that's wrong. I think the conception is, do you think literature should be a mirror, or do you think it should be a lamp, right? This is the classic dichotomy. Is it a mirror, or is it a lamp? Should it hold a mirror up to life and say, this is how life is? Or should it do something different, right? And this is what's so important about Romanticism and what we take from the Romantic poets, is especially the English Romantic poets, is this idea that literature can transform phenomenon, can transform existence. You don't have to take it on its own terms, right? You have the power to make your own terms. And so that was a bit of a lesson for me, I think, getting used to that switch from domestic bedroom dramas, which, let's be honest, is what every writer starts off writing, if you're certain MFA program in a certain state or what have you. God knows there's enough of them. And so I said Carverian before. I meant Raymond Carver and his beautiful short stories, which are so easy to imitate and so intoxicating, really. They're beautifully done, but they've been done.
A couple more, because we do want to get to the, make sure you get the books. I see one here. It's hard to see. Sorry.
Hi, my name's Charlotte.
Oops, is that on? Let's see.
Hi, I'm in the middle. Hello. I actually finished reading Rooms this morning, and it was a delicious, delicious book.
Delicious.
And this is like dessert, so thank you. I was mostly interested in Amy's voice. Amy's the little girl in the book, for those who haven't read it. We hear a lot of adult voices in the book. And I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit about the importance of having a more innocent, younger voice and a viewpoint in this novel full of people that are not so innocent.
Yeah, I mean, she's only given voice twice, I believe. And I mean, I think that for me, Amy is kind of, as many children are, the product of a very limited understanding of what is going on around them. And so I wanted to show through her voice the way that, you know, first of all, in some ways, I think that it just needed to happen because there is so much cynicism, so much kind of ugliness in the other characters as they're going through. Maybe even unconsciously, I kind of wanted a break. And she is. I mean, you know, in the story, there's also another fictional story called The Raven Heliotrope Reference, and there's a lot, that story is explicitly supposed to be kind of morality tale, not necessarily very well written, in which there is this idea of innocence, an innocent child or any innocent person who can redeem all of the other non-innocent people. And one of the ghosts who's haunted there and who has her own reasons for being preoccupied with the idea of childhood as innocence and innocence potentially destroyed, she's written this book. She's the author of this book. So Amy is meant to kind of serve as I mean, she is that innocent, and meant to evoke that as well in certain portions of the book.
She also scares the heck out of us because we're worried about her.
Well, right,
we think that these adults are going to, you know, right, let her fall through the cracks.
Burn the house down.
Right, yeah. Which so many parents do.
But did that answer your question? Okay,
yep. Thanks. And I think, can we try again here with the mic? Yeah.
Is this on now?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Charlotte, and thank you so much to all of you. It's so interesting and entertaining and wonderful. And I have two questions for Lauren. You had mentioned that you want to improve as a writer, and I was wondering if you could be more specific about what aspect.
I'm sorry, I missed
you. You want to improve as a writer, mm-hmm. And I was just hoping you could explain what specifically you'd like to achieve. And also, I was wondering, I know William had said that he doesn't always know where something is going to go, and he that's how he works, and that's, I think, how he wants it to be. I'm wondering, is that true for you too, Lauren, and maybe even for you, Ben? I know you wrote some fiction, so is it like that you don't really know where a story is going to go? Is that how you like it?
Well, in answer to your first question, it occurs to me I don't really know how to write novels, so I thought I should try to resolve that. No, I mean, specifically...
Really? I mean, do you really honestly mean that? Because I loved your book.
Well, no, I mean, I think that I'm always trying, but the problem is that the more you write, I mean, I've been publishing since I was relatively young, I was 26, and, you know, that means that I've published things that, you know, I would not have published today, and you learn through things that you're writing. Hopefully you get better with every book, but then with every book, then the next book you attempt to do, I always feel that I'm attempting to do something that I'm not quite yet qualified to do. And, I mean, specifically, pragmatically, many, many things. I am very, you know, for years and years and years, I felt that I could, like, write beautiful sentences. But I didn't know, and I, you know, in my early, I'm talking about like 21, 22, and then my first novels, when they got rejected, saying all of them, lyrical voice, beautiful voice, like no structure, no story. I was kind of like, whatever, read some Virginia Woolf, which of course she does have a story and structure, and it's just But so I have become actually really preoccupied with the intermarriage of structure and language, and I was trying to do it in rooms, and I think I got close, but didn't perfectly do it. Same thing with tone. I was trying to strike a very specific, delicate tone of kind of like a dark comedy that slowly devolves into less comedy and more darkness. You know, things that I was attempting to do that I, depending on your view of the book, you may feel I've done it more or less successfully. But those things, just, and really also each character's voice, like really, really nailing each character's voice again and again. So all of those things, I mean, just basically the general practice of writing. And then for me, no, I never know where a story is going to go at the start. Although I do, because of early experiences of getting many, many rejection letters saying, beautiful voice, not a single interesting thing happens in this 800-page novel. How is that even mathematically probable? I do at a certain point think about, you know, generally about conflict and, you know, the conflict and the propulsion and where things are going to be revealed, and then that becomes a very fluid working document. I constantly revise it as I'm writing.
I'm just going to ask Ben to answer that question as well, because I think, are we ready? Yeah.
Near
is that
the end?
5 minutes? Or are you saying hi? 5 minutes. Okay,
yeah,
so we do have some time.
Well, for the first part, I think it's amazing the self-criticalness. I was raised... My mother is the ultimate Jewish mother, that if I took a test and I didn't get an A, it was because there's something wrong with the test. And she would literally go to school 10 times, I remember this in high school, complaining that a test was miswritten because I didn't get an A. So I was granted this incredible delusional self-confidence, to the point where I graduated from college, I got 190 rejection slips. I had written 9 novels over 1 year. I taped them to the walls, and it just made me stronger in a way. And so I don't have that that thing that
did your mother see all those rejections?
Yeah, my mother's like, they're wrong.
They're wrong.
One of them is wrong.
She was right.
And that's what
she
I feel like. Everybody is wrong. And in terms of outlining, I'm a very strict. I hate the outline. I think it's the most miserable thing in the world. But for me, it's incredibly necessary. Not only do I outline every chapter in the book, I know exactly how many pages each chapter is going to be. I have every beat of everything outlined from beginning to end before I sit down to write. And I hate it. It's miserable. But I feel like without it, I drift and wander and go. So I always tell people, go for it, the outline, even though it's hellish. But some people don't write that way. Everyone writes differently. Yeah.
So do we have time for one last question? Or? Oh, very quick question. Don't we have a very quick question? Like, what's your favorite color? Something like that. Actually, what I'm going to do, I'll do one real quick. Each of you, name an author you'd want them to read. Annie Dillard.
Michael Crichton.
Not John Crowley.
Nice. Gerard Manley Hopkins.
Okay. And I would also recommend Ben, Lauren, and William. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And signings in the back.
Each other.
Yeah.
Missed opportunity.